Okay. And how did you first become involved in what was the Brooklyn community?
In the summer of 2001, the City Planning Commission of Charlotte, Charlotte Mecklenburg Planning Commission, had issued an RFP for the Second Ward Neighborhood Master Plan, at which time land design and a team consisting of FMK Architects and a Little John Group, Schimberg Levinas out of Washington, Deb Ryan, who is a professor at your university, pulled together and applied for that RFP, which we won, and began working on that proposal for a residential community in Second Ward in the fall of 2001.
Okay. So that explains the capacity in which land design is involved. Could you, for my information, explain what an RFP is?
It's a request for a proposal.
Request for proposal, okay.
When the city identifies projects to be either conceived, a vision plan or a master plan or even a construction plan, that they would have to issue publicly to qualified participants what's called an RFP, and that allows for, it's a public announcement of that, it allows for firms give them an equal basis of applying for that particular job.
And the concept in question here was making what was the Brooklyn neighborhood, or much of its previous boundaries, a residential community,
right,
again.
And just a year prior to that RFP, the city had concluded what was known as the 2010 Vision Plan. And that looked at the entire central business district, or essentially within the loop, the I-277 loop. It looked at all of those properties and began to define principles of urban design for the entire city, land uses, transportation improvements, public open space. And out of that document, it had identified the Second Ward area or the district to be primarily in the future a residential community, a residential neighborhood.
Okay.
And so this RFP essentially took that recommendation from that plan and took it the next step further.
All right. Now, I understand that Land Design did extensive research into the history of Second Ward and the areas that would be impacted by this project.
Sure.
What were some of the discoveries made during that process?
Well, you know, we first started looking at the Spangler Room in the library, looking up any historic context for that area, visited the Historic Landmarks website, the historic, I think it's called CM, Charlotte Mecklenburg Story website, I think it's cmstory.org.
Mm-hmm.
And started collecting you know, an abundance of information. Really, my understanding of, my first understanding of Brooklyn neighborhood even existing there. And so this was prior to responding to the RFP. We were sort of gathering this data, preparing for our interview and preparing for our presentation to the city to try to get the job. And so we were amazed at the fact that, although it's not uncommon in cities, amazed to the extent of which a knit, well-knit, and sort of tight community that once existed there. And it was pretty ironic because it was almost like what we were trying to emulate moving forward. But, you know, it had churches, and it had theaters, and it had the gamut of economic backgrounds of their citizens. It was pretty diverse in cultural and race, at least in the beginning. And so the more we looked into that and looked at how self-sufficient almost that neighborhood was as a community for downtown Charlotte, that was really the surprise. And it was, you know, the notion that a few years in the history of that could really change that course dramatically, and that would be obviously through the renewal process really change that neighborhood dramatically to what you see today.
Okay. Now, in that, in doing the research, how did the research influence your proposal?
Well, it it first of all had, gave us the framework for how we were going to attack the problem. We knew that there were physical situations that had manifested themselves since urban renewal, and that was the fabric, or what I would call the street grid or fabric, was really broken down, and now you have these sort of mega blocks. So we knew there was a physical approach to this project. We also, as we uncovered more and more, knew that there was going to be a social approach to this project. And we tried in our interview, and I think we got a clear understanding through the interview and early on in the process of how far the Planning Commission and the city wanted to breach that issue, the social issue. And obviously you can imagine that it's sensitive, and as we're moving forward and trying to develop vision plans, they wanted to make sure it was an inclusive process, that the citizens would be very much welcomed and even sought after. We would try to get as great of a cross-section of people coming to the public meetings for this process. And so that's sort of what we took off from. We needed to attack from those two angles.
Okay. Now, in creating that inclusive process, Land Design held a number of open house sessions. Were those to what target audiences were those sessions held, and what types of information would be presented at those meetings?
Sure. Well, I guess let's back up a little bit. Leading up to those public meetings, we had what were very direct stakeholder meetings, which would be the landowners themselves. This district is, or the study area, which was about 120 acres, was 80% owned by some government entity, either the city, the county, Board of Education, or NCDOT. And so we had interviews with those folks. We also had interviews with the Second Ward alumni in the museum, out at the museum on Bailey's Ford, the Convention Center folks, the hotel, adjacent hotel folks. You know, there aren't any people living in that area right now, so we were scratching our head as to who the residents would be, but we went out to Elizabeth and to Cherry and to Dilworth and to each of the other three wards, first, third, and fourth, and just targeted association leaders from all of those. So we tried to get as great of a cross-section of participants at these meetings. And the intent of, we had three, I believe. The initial meeting was to essentially discuss what the vision would be, and taking from the 2010 plan of this diverse neighborhood that we're trying to create, making sure that the types of uses that we were thinking about and how we were going to approach that physically and socially, just utilize the citizens at those meetings as a springboard and just get feedback. Okay, this is how we are going to look at affordable housing or workforce housing, and is this important to us that we try to make that happen? Is it important to us to try to create a diverse population there? Is it important to us, citizens of Charlotte, that it's residentially based, or should there be an entertainment base to it? And so those are the types of things that we were posing to the citizens at that time, and we were gathering all of that input and then coming back to them in the second meeting with sort of framework plans. Okay, we heard you the first time. We started looking at sort of if we're trying to create this residential neighborhood that looks as what you've pictured here, this is the type of infrastructure that we probably need here. What I mean by infrastructure in the streets, you know, right now it is not conducive to residential developments. It is more institutional, large block developments. And so we brought in several alternatives as to how we can reformulate Marshall Park to be sort of the center of that community rather than on the edge, and how new streets can be woven into that to much emulate what was there before. And at that meeting, they gave us feedback and started mapping out the types of uses that they had listed in the first meeting. You know, we need coffee shops, we need theaters. They started mapping those out with a series of exercises on those different framework plans. And we essentially took all that data and sort of came up with a composite framework plan after that second meeting.
Okay. I also understand that from those meetings, the, what was the Second Ward High School gymnasium became a key central piece. For what reason was that chosen?
Well, it was identified very early on, I think even in the RFP process, that there were a lot of sentiment, there was a lot of sentiment attached to that structure. You know, it was clear in everything that we read and the folks that we met that the Second Ward High School was the center of their universe. I mean, it was really the place of social gatherings and where the families came together, and so were the churches, but the you know, the high school was just well revered, and it was, you know, frankly, it was one of the best and definitely the first in the region to accommodate the African American population to any extent. And so that has remained, that gym has remained through the reconfiguration of what is now known as the Metro School, and it was evident early on that we needed to maintain that in some form, and as best that we could either reincorporate it into another school or some other use. I mean, we defined it in our plan as a potential community center. So it was really, again, back to the central focus of the neighborhood. It was, you know, many things were hinged around that, and the fabric that we created for that new neighborhood is that's the fulcrum. Again, it's the park that we recreated, and it is this community center. So you know, that carried through from day one.
Okay. In that, you've mentioned that there was some emotional response to the gymnasium being retained. Were there any other strong responses or unexpected responses from the community during this process?
I don't think they were unexpected. I mean, I guess the one thing that we weren't quite sure how socially things were going to evolve with this project. We didn't know if it was going to be a lot of confrontation from previous residents of Dark Glen or the Alumni Association. We were very surprised to just have great dialogue with them, and it wasn't a confrontation. You know, many times racial issues or urban renewal issues are very tough to get a handle on and to get a dialogue that's purposeful and meaningful, and it's just because of all of the heartache that's gone into history there. And so we were very well surprised, and it was welcoming to be able to just to have meaningful dialogue with Vermeil and some of the folks at the Second Ward High School alum, and many of the folks that are on the CMS board, the Arthur Griffins, and you know, people that knew the history of that area. That was a relief, I think, and you know, it made us want to even more so try to listen and weave as much as we could from what they were telling us into this plan. As far as the dialogue, other things other than the gymnasium, you know, we talked about the ability to get back a really affordable component to this neighborhood. And while some folks were really strong about that, they thought that that was the most important issue in here, many of them just felt like some reference to history is equally important. So we know that there's an economic issue with creating affordable housing and doing that in an effective way to where it's not an isolated pocket of things happening, but it's well integrated into the other housing. And so that's a tough issue, and we continue to have difficulty in doing that without subsidies. But weaving of history is something that you can quite easily do. It is the reference of that community, and it's not an economic thing, and it's really just a consciousness, a level of consciousness of making sure that whatever you propose there does bring out the fact that life has evolved in the piece of ground that you're on. And so it started as X, and it changed for some series of reasons, and now it's changing again, and it will change again in the future, just to measured, that we keep track of why, and to try to improve as we go along.
So does that mean that the proposed community will look, have some architectural feel like the old community, or?
Well, it could. I think there were, certainly some of the civic structures had a very distinct architecture. There were some very stately houses, and then there were some very, unstately houses. They were cabins or shacks. And so we pulled, as far as architectural style, we pulled from the vernacular of this region to try to define some limits to that. I think it's more so, just exuding within the neighborhood in any kind of public space that you create, be it the park, we have a series of parks, or a boulevard, or a place where people congregate, that some degree of identification of the type of community that was there. And the street network that we brought in, although it doesn't recreate what was there, it can't because of all the physical constraints that exist. We talked about street names and bringing back to life some names that we lost. And so that was, very small but meaningful to them, being able to do that. And even what you call this new neighborhood, do we want to call it Brooklyn again? Do we want to call it have some recognition of the name Brooklyn? And although we didn't land on what that was, that dialogue was there. We sort of explained some of those types of ways that we could pay homage to the past.
Very good. Most of what you were doing, you had to work with the city extensively. Were there any unexpected roadblocks or challenges in working with the city?
I think the biggest challenge, I would have to say, you have, again, the property was owned by three governmental agencies, or primarily three governmental divisions. One was the city, and the county, and the Board of Education. What was difficult was trying to get them all thinking about the same vision. They all have their charge of what they're trying to do, and while the Planning Commission may embrace the vision of a neighborhood, the city and the county and the manager's office or whoever and the Board of Education also have concurrent desires of what city land should be. And so it was a little bit difficult. It was easy to get by sort of a mission statement. Mm-hmm. We want this community to feel and to be a residential community and to be vibrant and rich and diverse. Nobody had many questions about that. It's really getting into the implementation of it. And in order to do that, in order to achieve that level of diversity, it requires some sacrifice on all of their parts, either with land values and write-downs or with much better coordination between the three entities of how they develop land, or if they develop land, whether or not they sell it and have somebody who does develop land much more effectively than they do take it on. And so when we start getting into implementation and the major movements that we were going to expect to reinvent this neighborhood, which would mean some of those government uses that exist there now needed to be relocated, such as the Board of Education, or such as Walton Plaza, or such as the Aquatic Center. All those things that was tough getting some degree of consensus as to how we move the chess pieces in order to get this neighborhood to reinstate.
So it would appear, we're changing back, were there any expected rewards in working with the city in terms of support or information or?
I think that the city has a very strong desire to make what we've laid out here happen. And although there's some things that need to fall in place as far as implementation aspect, and who are the drivers of that, who's really leading the charge in order to get this neighborhood recreated over time, there's a desire to get that diversity down there. to maybe more so than what we've seen in some of the other neighborhoods, and major redevelopments that have in some of the other neighborhoods downtown. I think, you know, they're committed to trying to bring workforce housing into this area, and to what degree they would bring affordable housing into this area, I'm not sure, but that would, and I really do think that it opened up, one of the interesting things, that it opened up dialogue between those three entities at probably a higher level socially than they've been involved for a while. So, you know, they come together quite frequently about fiscal issues, but they were really thinking about collectively how to make things happen, and I think that's very important.
Going back in time from what you just said, do you have a feel for what was the lever that put this project in motion?
What or who the lever was?
Who would be a good answer too?
Well, I think the city has some visionaries. You know, certainly Martin Crampton is a visionary, and he, along with his staff, took the recommendations of the 2010 vision plan, which was built by the citizens, and it was a very inclusive process. They took that very seriously. Excuse me. And they, I think, even before that, I'm certain, even before that, that one could, that is familiar with urban design and how cities grow, could take a look at that property that exists there now and understand, even just from a context standpoint, not socially, but just from a physical standpoint, that it is highly underutilized. I mean, it is very suburban in nature. So, and the fact that there aren't any residents in there now, you have residents in every one of the other wards, but not this one. And so, you know, when we start talking about what makes cities great, it's people living down there, and I think that the combination of acknowledging that, okay, we have a very monoculture in the second ward right now, we need to diversify and get people living down there, and it's not efficient in the way it's built. And we also have plans on the table to consolidate government space that's downtown. They went through an extensive inventory of all of the different government departments. They came up with a government district master plan, which consolidated some of these defunct uses and spaces that aren't that efficient for them, and put them in a more compact urban form. And so all of those things led to the aha, let's go ahead and take what was recommended in 2010, the next step, and at least build the next level of framework for us to move forward.
I mean, from my perspective, what you're saying sounds as though things have almost come full circle, that the residents and the citizens of the city have an exciting plan, and the group that's having to endure change and the consequences of change appears to be the city this time, that the different departments are the ones that are having to adapt, and the citizens are the ones that are going to see the immediate benefit this time, whereas urban renewal appeared to put the burden on the residents, and the city saw the immediate.
Right. That's interesting. That's an interesting viewpoint. I mean, certainly, I don't think it's going to be the same magnitude and threshold of pain, but I think that is an interesting way of looking at it, is that the city is going to, in order to do what they have decided collectively as a vision to pull off in that district, that there's going to be some sacrifice.
Are there any hopes or visions for what was the Brooklyn community that haven't been part of the program? Are there just additional items you'd like to see personally in what's occurring with the plan?
I think the plan approached as far as physically, Interstate 277 was a tough animal to deal with, and I don't think we quite got, nor do I think a lot of the plans that approach the different districts in the city get to bridging the gap, the severing of the neighborhoods adjacent to Sim City. And what I mean by is that I-277 comes in roughly at the same time or renewal happens, and really just cuts it off, cuts the city off from Elizabeth and Cherry and Wesley Heights. And I wish one plan would focus on how to improve that to a great extent, because that is that's a barrier. And you know, while we try to address it, it's just a big issue. It's got, you know, you've got the federal DOT involved with that, and it's a tough issue to deal with. So that was one thing that we've gotten into a little bit deeper. What was the second part of that question?
I think that covers the answer. The next question is really a chance for you to bring up whatever you would like to speak on, and that is the questions we have are very directed to answering what we have. Is there anything that you would like to state or is not part of the questions that should be part of the record for what's occurring with the future of what was the Brooklyn neighborhood?
I think the ability for cities to focus on how they enable diverse economic backgrounds to live in the city, that needs to be brought to the forefront. I know that the current economic development department, at the time that they're all quite stretched as far as their departments in the city, and they essentially go and tackle and focus on the thing that's screaming the loudest. And I think what's interesting about the second ward is that it really is a benign area. I mean, it doesn't have a lot of people aren't screaming about it. There's not a perceived notion of crime there. There's not there aren't residences that are causing a stir about certain things. And there's really not a ton of businesses or development that's wanting to engulf it. So it's really not screaming for attention. But that's a good thing. That allows us to prepare the strategy and to take our time with it. One thing we were trying to stress in this plan is that the slow incremental growth of these neighborhoods is going to achieve probably the desired effect rather than a huge entity coming in and taking a large plot of land and building from scratch in a matter of 5 to 10 years a new neighborhood. I really don't think we're going to achieve the level of diversity and the vision of this neighborhood and that approach. With that approach, I think we need to take our time, make movements slowly, check them with what we've laid out as a vision, bring them to the public and get their response to it, and make sure that as we move forward with that, that we clearly think about how we implement economic diversity. And there's some evidence of that in First Ward and other developments. Typically, it is a subsidy that needs to happen, and just how you structure that, but there are other avenues to allow that to happen with certain types of mortgages, how you structure parking, and how that economic of uptown parking, which is a very expensive element, gets shared with the region or whole district rather than per project or development. And so there are things that we wove into that, but the ability for the city to really focus on those issues and to have a clear strategy on how they will get those things done and the alliances they need to build in order to accomplish that, alliances with private community, alliances with each other, the different departments. I think that, I hope as we continue to study the life of Charlotte, that department builds stronger and stronger, the economic development department builds stronger in conjunction with the Planning Commission and other departments.
One last question then. This will take time. Looking at it to your best estimate, from today to when you can call that area a community again, how many years are we looking at?
You know, we We have looked at a 25-year period, 25-plus-year period for the type of build-out of the city and the 2010 planning vision. I mean, I think it was in the order of 2,500 residents living in that geography. Whether or not that's realistic, or it's, you know, I think that we've seen instant communities pop up all over the city and on the outskirts of the city in a matter of years. And really, if we start looking at such as First Ward and how that matured from Earl Village to what it is now, we probably would have challenged the density had we done it slower and in more compact pieces. I think there was a desire for the city to do that immediately, to make a major change and to move on. So, you know, I wouldn't mind this taking 50 years. Once the first sort of assemblage of residents populate that and create what they feel as a community, you're on the right path, and that could happen in a matter of years. But the overall build out, I think we just need to take our time.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. And I thank you very much for participating today.
Sure.